Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Good evening. Who's been to a Word in Your Ear before? Oh, okay. So those of you who've been here before know it's our proud boast that we start early and finish early. So you can be looking at the inside of your lids by about 9:15 if you want, or watching a game of association football, which I understand might be taking place in some other area of London later this evening. Welcome to the first Word in Your Ear of the year. I think it's fair to say that Mark and I have worked together for a long time on music magazines and music programmes, radio programmes, TV programmes, whatever. And during that time, we have spoken disrespectfully of pretty much everybody in popular music over the years. And we've tended to accuse them of very much the same crimes that occurred again and again. Very often they lose sight of the fact that that musician is a kind of craft first and an art second. They lose sight of that very early on, and if they have 1.5 hit records, many of them expect to be carried around in a sedan chair for the rest of their lives. I don't think either of those accusations could be levelled at our guest this evening. Who in the course of a career, which when you think about it, is pretty much unprecedented. You know, if you wrote it in a movie script, nobody would believe that anybody could do all those different things. But he's never been guilty of either of those sins. He's in the next year, he's undertaking two tours of the UK and beyond, so he may be playing in a city near you. The second of those tours is with a full-scale band, which is marking an anniversary of, I suppose, what you might call his Annus Mirabilis, which is kind of 40 years ago, in what happened in 1979, which we'll come to later. But first of all, he's going to be touring in a show where he will play and also answer audience questions. So in order to get himself up to, you know, to his speed in terms of answering questions, he's very kindly volunteered to answer some questions from Mark and myself this evening. Would you please welcome the one, the only, Midgeo.
Yeah, this is like doing press-ups, isn't it? Preparing for the tour.
Yes, and there in three pictures we have the young Midge. The smash hit sensation cover star,
the Macintosh years,
and the mature man. Can we say that, Mitch?
It's like an advert for Regain in reverse.
Well, okay. Now, where we traditionally start, Midge, on Word in Your Ears, we always ask people the same question, which is: when you were growing up, what kind of record player, music playing apparatus was there in your home? Can you remember?
Yeah, it was a radio, quite simply. I don't think we got a record player until I was maybe 10 or 11. And even then, we couldn't afford to buy the records. So we borrowed all these records, old things, from my cousin. But the radio was constantly on in our house.
What was on the radio? Can you remember?
Everything. Because it was the light service or the
light
home
program.
Service, whatever it was.
Light
yeah,
program,
that.
Yeah.
A light program.
So you got everything from Mantovani to, you know, Telstar. So it was a very bizarre but fulfilling kind of musical apprenticeship. So long before I got anywhere near a guitar, these fantastic melodies were rattling around my head that I was hearing from the radio.
Is that something, seriously, is that something you value looking back on it? You know, that you heard this wide range of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because the first tune I can remember hearing that made any sense to me was a thing called Sleepwalk by Santo and Johnny, which was an instrumental, yeah, this haunting, yeah, beautiful instrumental. Played on a lap steel guitar. Beautiful thing. And I think that's what made me think, a guitar, something makes that noise. And I couldn't have been any older than like 5 or 6 or something when that was on the radio. So, yeah, it was really important.
So you were born in Glasgow in 1953? Okay.
Yep.
What's your earliest memories of Glasgow?
It was shit. It was.
Does it involve rain by any chance?
It was, you know, I'm saying it was shit. It was great because it was home. But I was born in a tenement slum. You know, the outside toilet and no heating to speak of, a coal fire. One bedroom flat type thing where the cooker, there was no kitchen, the cooker was in the hallway. You walked in the front door, the cooker was there. One door led to the bedroom and the other led to the sitting room, which had a thing probably native to Glasgow, native to Scotland, a thing called a cavity bed.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A hole
that's
in the wall.
Tenement.
Right, okay.
Original tenement, yeah.
So a proper
and there
tenement.
And there were five of you, weren't there?
Five of us in there, yes, eventually, yeah. So, so it was pretty basic stuff. But you don't know it's basic because everyone else is in the same boat. So yeah. I didn't think anything of it. But I loved Glasgow because of its character and its people. And the hard life that you had gave you something to write about, gave you something to escape from. Not to escape being Scottish, but to escape from the misery that your parents must have been in. Because it was hideous. My dad was a van driver and earned £6 a week. At his peak, £6 a week. That's a tough life.
And what was the main Glaswegian characteristic? It was just that kind of...
Humour.
Well, tough...
Humour, absolutely. Yeah. You know, that it's... It's why,
give us an example of Glaswegian humour.
Well, you know, it wasn't so long ago. I was maybe, I don't know, 20 years ago or whatever. I was in Glasgow and a fairly noticeable character in Glasgow. And I'm standing in the bank when you're to write a cheque for cash. And the teller on the other side of the window never even looked at me. Nothing. And I'm writing the cheque out, and I, you know, two cash, thanks very much, and I hand it to him. And without looking up, he says, "Are you up to see your mammy then?" That was it. You know, I'm not going to say, "Well done, love your records, you're a wanker." None of that. Just straight in, you know. And you think that it's fantastic. It's great. So underplayed. It's beautiful.
So how did you get on at school?
I didn't. I hated it. They wouldn't teach me anything I wanted to learn. It was a time of the 3 R's, the reading, writing, arithmetic thing, and I was rubbish at all of them. No interest in them whatsoever. I could draw and I could paint and I could sing because singing didn't cost anything. But I wasn't allowed near a piano. The school had one piano. They wouldn't let you touch it.
Really?
I didn't have a guitar till I was 10. So it was weird because I excelled at underachieving because it was of no interest to me at all. You know, I've never had to use maths again.
And you finished up in an engineering job, didn't you? When you were sort of, was it 15 or 16 or something?
I left school at 15 simply because of that. Simply because I asked to have as many music lessons as possible, and they couldn't see that maybe I wasn't, you know, factory fodder, and which I ended up being, of course, or that I was slightly different. And in fact, it was so ridiculous that nobody had said, okay, you can draw and you can paint. If you try a little bit harder at the other things, you can maybe go to the Glasgow School of Art.
Yeah.
But it was never mentioned.
Yeah,
it was
true.
Never mentioned at all.
Yeah.
So I was kind of left on my own to my own devices. And I left school at 15 as soon as I could. I went to an academy, which was a tough school to get into academically. And I got in because I had a high IQ, not because I could do anything. And I left as soon as I possibly could. Got an apprenticeship at the National Engineering Laboratories and a 4-year engineering apprenticeship. And I left halfway through it.
And joined a band, right?
Well, I was playing in bands since I was like, you know, 13 or 14. A band, of course, is just, you know, a mate with a guitar.
Yeah.
You know, you find like-minded people. You find somebody else has got a guitar, you find somebody else has got a guitar, somebody's got a drum and a cymbal, and that's it. You sit in, you know, each other's bedrooms playing Beatles tunes over and over and over, trying to figure out what the next chord is. That's what you did. And then you graduated into doing Scout Halls and all of that stuff. So I was playing in bands at weekends all the way through this.
So were the Beatles the thing that kind of they inspired were, you?
Kind of. I mean, yeah, of course, you couldn't not be affected by the Beatles. But for me, it was the Small Faces.
Oh, right.
Okay. Yeah, they were fantastic. I mean, I just loved the kind of the cheeky attitude, the great songwriting. You know, Stevie Marriott had a brilliant voice.
Fantastic.
But they were small. You know, they were little guys with big guitars, and they thought, I can do that.
You could never tell they were small when you saw them all together because they were all the same height.
That was amazing.
There's no sense of
you could
scale.
All swap clothes, yeah.
That's right.
No, perspective.
The guitars kind of swamped them, didn't they, really?
They did. Yeah, they started off with these massive, great big things.
Yeah.
But they were so cool. I loved it.
I think this was a particular. We're looking at a cover of John Mayall's Blues Breakers with Eric Clapton from, when are we talking about, 1966?
66, yeah.
Something like that?
66. Yeah.
Was that a particular...?
Of course. This would have happened around about the British blues boom, when all of a sudden Britain found American roots for some reason and developed their own particular styles. So John Mayall's Blues Breakers had been around for quite a while. They had a history of having brilliant guitar players. And, of course, there's a young Eric Clapton reading the Beano there. And it was just, it was glorious to me. As an aspiring musician, a head full of broken bottles and attitude, I was sitting with my guitar, listening to this stuff, thinking, oh, the blues, that's me. That's me, you know, white guy from Glasgow, the blues.
Right.
Please.
Same for every other.
Well, they were white guys who
went
straight
to the toilet, you know.
Yeah. They had no more right than you did.
Absolutely. In fact, they were a lot more posh than I was. So I just loved this. This whole British blues boom thing was great. If you had a guitar, you had to be into this. You had to take it to the next level. And, of course, this is what changed guitar sounds. Guitar sounds up to this point was like the Shadows. It's clean and twangy and stuff.
Yeah.
And these guys kind of cranked the amps up, and all of a sudden there was sustain and distortion, and it was so ridiculously exciting for a young guitarist. So, yeah, I loved this.
Don't you think it's amazing when you look at this cover, that how overused word iconic this cover turned out to be? Just because he's reading the Beano, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Take away the Beano, it's just four blokes sitting, against a wall.
I can remember at school, Mitch and I were born pretty much the same day, the same year, actually, so probably the same year. I can remember people buying the Beano and bringing it in and carrying it around because Eric Clapton read the Beano. I mean, it became, immediately you talked about, whoever it was, Desperate Dan or Nasher or whatever,
They might have done better if they bought a guitar.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
So do you play this kind of stuff? Do you play the blues?
I thought I did, but I learned all my guitar riffs from Eric Clapton. In fact, there's a couple of things I have to tell you. I used to have a little house out in the island of Montserrat in the Caribbean, and I say used to because
the one that burnt down.
No. The hurricane got
a hurricane.
It, and I rebuilt it, and then the volcano erupted.
That's right.
Before all that happened, Eric was on Montserrat. Recording at Air Studios and playing guitar on Sting, one of Sting's albums. So he turned up for a week to play on Sting's album. Sting wasn't even there. He just said play all over it. So he did. And one day he played everything and then hung out for the rest of the week. And we sat together with a guitar each in my little house playing old blues tunes. And he said, "How do you know that?" I said, I learned it from you.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
That's absolutely extraordinary.
That's fantastic. Yeah, like identical little riffs.
Yeah.
He must be.
But one of your first bands was named after a tune on this record. Is
the Stumble.
Right? The Stumble.
The Stumble. Yeah, I was 16 and brainless, and we called ourselves the Stumble, but we weren't allowed to play any blues tunes because in Scotland at the time the licensing laws. Wouldn't allow you to perform in a pub or a club for money. So the church ran the licensing laws. So we had no pub rock circuit where you could go and go up and play this kind of stuff or play some rock music or play your own tunes or whatever. You had to be a human jukebox. So back then, I suppose, with Slick, you'd be playing Son of My Father, or, you know, there we go, looking at really uncool look, but what a cool guitar I had. Look at that.
Yeah, we're looking at
That's
the group
cool
Salvation.
Guitar.
This is Salvation. It was all
Salvation.
Silver trousers and, you know, wing collars and waistcoats and feather cuffs.
It was a kind of glam period, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Glam time. This was,
1971?
1972, I suppose.
Yeah.
Just when... there was something in the water in 1972. Something happened because we had, you know, David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust album. We had... you know, Queen and Cockney Rebel and, you know, Roxy Music, all of a sudden this thing happened, you know, musically and fashion-wise. So I suppose that was a...
And you were in
a,
didn't you have a residency in a disco in Glasgow called Clouds? Was it called Clouds?
It was a, Glasgow's big venue was the Glasgow Apollo. It was originally the Greens Playhouse, which is like the, one of the biggest theatres or cinemas in Europe. And above it, there was a massive ballroom that held maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people. Huge place, big sprung floor. And we used to play there every other weekend. You know, between, there was one in Glasgow and one in Edinburgh. So we didn't have to travel very far to do our
And playing covers, mostly covers.
Playing covers,
so what
yeah.
else did you do?
Yeah, go on,
give us a set list.
Set list.
Well, right about this time.
A level
list. Yeah, right about this time. We'd, you know, we'd do Virginia Plain, and we'd do, you know, we'd do some proper stuff. That This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us, Sparks. Very high to sing,
right? Say.
You know,
quite demanding stuff.
It was good. We would pride ourselves on the covers we'd do.
Right,
we wouldn't do any old crap.
Well, Dave, but what a
seriously,
what an education.
I said when I introduced you that business of craft and art. You know that. You know, people nowadays look down their noses at bands who play covers, you know.
Oh,
the Beatles were playing covers.
The Beatles were a cover. Every band coming out of Ireland was in a show band.
Show band, precisely.
All the
Rory
great
Gallagher.
Guitarists. Yeah, Rory Gallagher, Gary Moore, you know, all these guys.
Phil Lynott.
They all played in show bands because that's all you were allowed to do. That's how you learned your craft. You know, you didn't just go on a talent show and do a bit of karaoke.
But also must have fed into the songs that you wrote yourself, you know, having covered so many different types of music.
Yeah, that was the downfall. It really wasn't good. When you started writing your own songs, they were so derivative of everything you were playing at the time.
Right.
So I've got songs that I recorded on cassettes and whatever that sound exactly like David Bowie or sound exactly like Roxy Music, you know, just not as good. And that's how you kind of start the process. You don't go to school or college or uni to learn how to write a song. You have to start by writing songs that sound like everyone else.
Yeah, yeah.
And then hopefully develop your own style as you go along.
Yeah.
So that was your set list, repertoire. Who were the audience?
Oh, an audience. It was a disco. I mean, that's what you did. You were the visuals in amongst an evening of records.
Right.
So it was just a disco. It would start at like 7:30 at night, and you would do your 2 45-minute spots, and the girls would all stand along the front of the stage like that, watching you.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they put records on when you.
So was that a rough old setup with the fights and, you know,
not necessarily in that place, chakra. But yes, I mean, we used to. There was a place at Cumnock Town Hall, which is in Ayrshire, which could have been a million miles away from where we were in Glasgow. And it's where the Bay City Rollers got the look, because people really did dress like that, with the tartan and the trousers.
Three-quarter length trousers.
But you wouldn't laugh at these guys,
because
they were all skinheads, and they were vicious.
Yeah.
And as you're standing playing at one of these things, you would just see it happen. Something would explode, a fight would happen, and then the whole room would part, and both sides, it was like Cochise and, you know, and the cavalry, and they just run at each other, bang, and you couldn't stop playing, because then it would get bad.
Right. Yeah, it would get worse. Yeah.
So did you start to notice this quite early on? You know, you've got this the curiously kind of combustible mix, haven't you? Because you've got girls looking at you, and then you've got drunk or kind of tense guys jealous of the attention you're getting from the girls. Do you learn anything about how to handle that other than to just keep playing?
Yeah, run. You could pick up the sign language, which was usually you.
Right.
And you're standing playing, shaking, thinking, Jesus.
Mitch is miming some kind of facial laceration.
For viewers at home.
And it was scary stuff. I mean, it's kind of what it was. But that's not peculiar to Scotland. I mean, that's, you get that everywhere.
No.
You know, drink and rivalry and tribalism.
Yeah.
And religion, throw that in the mix. And all of a sudden, you've got a good Saturday night.
So when do you turn professional? What year?
72.
Were you seen in that group when you joined Slick? Were you seen in Playing in Salvation and then auditioned on the basis of that? Well, how did you get into Slick?
Slick was Salvation.
Oh, it was the same group.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
The guy who was in the middle there, the big tall guy with the sparkly trousers, he was the singer. I was the guitarist. I didn't even go for the audition. I went with the Stumble. I was still in Stumble at the time, and we had a keyboard player we didn't like. And he wanted to audition to join Salvation as a keyboard player. And I went with him to try and get rid of him. And they didn't offer him the job. They offered me a job as a guitarist. So I joined Salvation as a guitar player, left my apprenticeship, which is a dodgy thing to do in the first place. And then eventually, 2 or 3 years later, the singer left the band. You know, we went to see a Dirty Harry movie one afternoon, came out and had her hair cut, and ended up with Quiffs, and we changed the name to Slick.
And the two writers were Bill Martin and Phil Coulter, I think, who had written, they'd written Congratulations, they'd written Puppet on a String, they'd written Shang-a-Lang.
Tell us a bit about them.
They're interesting guys, and much, much older than you guys, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, they were hugely... They were a hit factory. You know, they were a hit factory in the 70s. And as you said, they did the Rollers and Kenny and a whole pile of other things, and they seemed unstoppable. For some strange reason, Bill Martin, the guy on the left there, at the top, was in Glasgow, in the Glasgow Apollo, when we were rehearsing upstairs in the ballroom. And he heard us, and he thought it was the record, and he stuck his head around the corner, and there's these four youngish guys, you know, playing This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us, or whatever it was, and said, I'll offer you a record deal. And although it was a shit record deal, but it was a great record deal because it was the only one we were ever going to get. Because everything was London-centric. You know, we had no independent labels. You know, nobody'd go to Scotland to go and see any bands. A&R guys wouldn't be interested. So it was the only record deal we were going to get. So we did the record deal thinking naively that we'd be able to work our way out of having to record their songs. And we turned up in London to make a record with a van, a 3-ton van full of equipment, having driven it from Glasgow. We turned up in South Moulton Street, just down the road, and went into the studio. And there's a backing track playing by the same guys who played all the Bay City Rollers records. They had the session guys in that morning, and they knocked it off really quickly. And
you just
so you didn't
sing
need
it.
Your van.
So you had no idea that you weren't being invited to play on your own records.
How did you feel? I was horrified. I mean, and Bill Martin took me out into the middle of the street in South Moulton Street, which is quite a busy little thoroughfare. And I'm a kid, and he's screaming in my face.
Really?
You know, absolutely screaming in my face. Get up there, sing this fucking song. You want to hit this? All of that, and then sang this thing. And when I got the phone call a few months later telling me it was number one, I didn't feel anything. I had nothing to do with it whatsoever, other than just stand on top of the pops miming the thing.
Did they direct you a lot? I mean, did they tell you what to wear and how to act in interviews and all that? I was still you. It wasn't that kind of traditional boy band thing.
We'd been playing the Scottish circuit for, you know, 3 or 4 years at this time.
Yeah.
I have to point out, I've been very kindly given by somebody who's here this evening a copy of the Record Mirror and Disc from 1976, where there you are, you made the centre spread.
That's me.
In Slick. You didn't keep that for your scrapbook.
I've got a pile of stuff, but I think these days everything's on the internet. I thought my kids might be interested one day. No such luck.
Yes. But you write in the book about the transformational moment of being on Top of the Pops, because Top of the Pops was just, you know, there's no equivalent now, is there? I mean, you could just go from being unknown to being absolutely recognised in the street.
Well, our Top of the Pops, our first appearance on Top of the Pops was on New Year's Day, it must have been New Year's Day 1976. And what had happened was Top of the Pops had invited four new bands who were all releasing singles in 76 to come on Top of the Pops for the New Year's Day special. So we came in, we did our thing, and within 24 hours later, all hell had broken loose. Everything had changed because we'd been seen on television. And we hadn't changed. We hadn't done anything. You know, we'd gone to London, do the programme, get on a train to get back home because you don't want to be in England in New Year. You know, we went back up to Scotland. And it was completely different. And, I don't know, 20-plus million people mm-hmm. would have seen that show. And it's just, it was unbelievable.
So did people start to recognise you in the street?
Oh, yeah, it was pretty recognisable walking about like that.
Right. Yeah.
This is at a time when everyone else had feather cut hair and flares.
That's right.
You know.
When I mean, the Bay City Rollers happened a little bit before you, so did you look at the Bay City Rollers and in any way envy what they had?
Oh God, no.
Then you were by working with Coulter and Martin, who wrote all their songs, yeah. and by going into the same kind of factory, you were headed that way, though, weren't you?
Yeah. Well, the problem is once you've done that, and that's why I keep saying it was naivety. Once you have been tarred with that brush, it's almost impossible to shake it off. So you will always be seen as that, because everything that happens in your life that's a little peak is a reference point. So if I do an interview tomorrow with a magazine, they'll bring up Joe fucking Dolce and they'll bring up Slick.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Drop the Joe Dolce slide, Dave. Talk among yourselves for a minute.
I got that. Yeah. But I will mention it when we get to it.
But fascinatingly, that Malcolm McLaren, around this time, 75, 76, approached you, didn't he? And was already trying to put together the basis of the Sex Pistols. So yeah. How did he see, if you were this person, as you say, tarred by the brush of being in a kind of what seemed to be a boy band, how did he see that potential in you?
Well, he saw me. In fact, it wasn't him who saw me. It was a guy called Bernie Rhodes, who went on to manage The Clash.
Bernie Rhodes, yeah.
And I have to give you a little backstory to this. I was associated, my management owned the Glasgow Apollo, so Slick were being managed by these guys. This is before the first record had come out for Slick. It was in the offing, so it was going to happen, but we didn't know when. And what used to happen is when bands came to play the Glasgow Apollo and something broke, you know, their equipment or whatever, there were no rental companies up there unlike here, you know. You can't just phone someone up and they just bring it round. So they'd send somebody round to the local guitar shop and say, Midge is probably around here, go and find him and he'll sort you out with an amplifier or whatever. And I'm walking out this music shop, and this guy stops me and said, will you speak to my mate round the corner? And he was English, which is an unusual thing in Glasgow. And I thought, oh, okay, this is what it's about. And round the corner, sitting in his beat-up old car, is the most bizarre, effeminate man I'd ever seen in my life, Malcolm McLaren. I didn't know it was Malcolm McLaren. He's sitting with his black mohair jumper and a dog collar, which again was kind of unusual in Glasgow.
In Glasgow. I was going to say, that's brave.
And they start talking to me, the two of them, and I'm saying, oh, okay, yeah. And he says, oh, yeah, I used to manage bands and, you know, the New York Dolls and, you know, Seditionaries or Sex or whatever it was at the time, a shop, and Vivian Westwood, and he's telling me all this stuff and his whiny voice. And then he said, and I'm putting this band together and, you know, do you want to join? And I thought, well, you don't know what I do. You haven't asked if I'm a singer or a guitarist or even if I'm a musician. You don't know. So I said, no, thanks. And the band was the Pistols, of course. So the reason they were in Glasgow was they'd some slightly hot equipment in the boot of their car. So I didn't join the Pistols, but I bought an amp.
All right. Did you ever, when you saw what happened to them, were you regretful?
No, not at all, because they put together the best band ever. It was great. You know, you couldn't imagine the Pistols without any one of them being in the setup, and especially if it was going to be the singer. You know, Lydon was the perfect guy for that.
So how were the Bay City Rollers regarded amongst the Scottish kind of musical fraternity at this time?
Well, the Rollers had been around for a long time before they discovered the tartan trimmings and started having the hits.
Tripping.
So they weren't a great band. They were okay. So they weren't really regarded as much at all. There were much better bands in Scotland at the time. Tear Gas, who became the sensational Alex Harvey band.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
There were bands like that doing the circuit, which were fantastic. You know, The Beings, which had Hamish from Average White Band in it. So there were a lot of really good bands up there. So the Rollers were just a kind of fluff thing.
Right. How do you then go from that to the Rich Kids?
Pure luck. We eventually, Slick, the straw that broke the camel's back was we were now being allowed to play on our own records. We played in the album and whatever. But they insisted on writing the songs because obviously 50% of the money generated from a hit single goes to the writers. And they wanted that, of course. And we weren't very skilled at writing songs. So we turned up at the studio one day and the song that was written for us was "The Kid's a Punk." And the opening line went, "Hey, hey, hear what they say. He looks just like James Dean." And we went, "Fuck it, that's it. I can't do this anymore."
No.
And we broke the contract. So we thought naively we'd get signed again, which we didn't. And I got a telephone call from Glenn Matlock, ex-Sex Pistol, saying he's putting his new band, The Rich Kids, together, who were all over the papers at the time, even though they hadn't done anything. Everyone's talking about this band, The Rich Kids, going to be the saviour of rock and roll and whatever.
Is that because they had Glenn Matlock in it?
I think it was because Glenn was in there, and also I think Pete Silverton, who wrote for Sound, was a big fan and whatever. But he called me because another journalist, Caroline Kuhn, from Melody Maker, had seen Slick perform live, and I think she fancied the bass player, and she said, "He's the guy that you need for your band." So, out the blue, nothing to do with me at all.
And the press was incredible when you joined. I reviewed you for the NME, I remember, the Greyhound in Croydon in 1978.
Mark, I have to say, dug out today his old review of The Rich Kids.
But it's so awful.
And he was so shameful. He said, I said, "You've got to read it out." He said, "No, I don't think I dare," but he's going to.
Well, I'm not going to read that a tiny bit because it's just so awful. I was just thinking how awful it would be to actually read this sort of thing about you. Yeah, this was the Croydon Greyhound. It says, the band's image, imagine a really pretentious.
Just talk
NME,
like a, talk like a rock critic. Image.
Yeah. I'm probably wearing, actually, I did have a pair of plastic fake leather trousers at the time, you know, and red shoes. Yeah. Red shoes with yellow lace. Yeah, the band's image of dry, clean determination was a monumental blast. Far more abrasive vocal command from Midgeo than Glenn Matlock, and an underlying cardiac barrage with a bass that could warp floorboards at 100 yards. Yes.
Here comes
the payoff.
Okay.
This prize wanker here thinking he says if they can inject some of their creative energy into the slightly flagging world of new wave. Another way to take the whole landscape there and describe it as slightly flagging, you know, and produce something radically different, then the Rich Kids will pass the survival test. Can you imagine writing anything more? You must have looked at things like that and just howled with laughter.
It's God, awful. That's fantastic.
But of course, you were support. I think you were support. Landscape, actually.
Really?
Called Landscape. Do you remember they had a hit called Einstein and Go-Go? That's them, yeah. But I remember it really well. And the press about the Rich Kids was enormous, just huge.
It was.
There was so much interest.
But when the album came out, it was just didn't happen at all, did it?
No.
And it was power pop.
Well, yeah, again, you guys are responsible for all that shit.
Yeah, I do.
Absolutely.
It was him.
Tossers in the NME.
Who came up with New Romantics, power pop? Yeah. You know, all of this. It was nonsense. But anyway, we fell on stony ground. Of course, a bit. We were somewhere between Elvis Costello and the Boomtown Rats. I don't know. We just didn't get it at all. I think, you know, Steve was 17. You know, good looking young kid on guitar. It was, you know, we're a vibey little band, but we weren't given enough chance to grow up a bit. You know.
Did you despair at this point? You know, you've had two shots. Did you think about, I'm going to jack it in, I'm going to go back and become an engineering apprentice again?
Well, you know, I mean, at this point I was ensconced in, you know, being in London, my feet were under the table, I would, you know, the band was changing, what was happening around the band was changing. If truth be told, the thing that split the band up wasn't musical differences like, you know, you do. It was a synthesizer. You know, I was Rusty, the tall one at the back there, was running a little night in a club in Soho, Billy's. And this night was Bowie night. And a lot of the kids who had started the whole kind of new wave punk explosion had moved on and walked away from it all because it was now high street fashion and it was boring and it was, you know, third generation crap punk bands. You know, they moved away from it and they wanted something else. So they reverted back to their original love, which is Roxy Music and David Bowie and all of that, mixed with a lot of music coming out of Europe of all places, mm-hmm. you know, this electronic stuff. So Rusty and I used to go to these nights, you know, Steve Strange and all these kids all starting to dress up, and this emergence of technology getting involved in music, you know, synthesizers, drum machines, all of that. I started getting really influenced by what I was hearing and wanted to integrate this, not disco stuff like a synthesizer would have been used for, but to integrate synthesizers with a rock band. And I thought, the Rich Kids, we could do that. And we started doing it. And Glenn and Steve absolutely hated it. And that's what split the band up.
So they were the kind of rock and roll purists, they felt that.
I think they thought they'd get. Glenn was quite right. He said, if we're going to have a keyboard player, let's get somebody that can play. Because I couldn't play.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so he had a point.
It's a fair point.
It's a fair point. Yeah. But he missed the point, because the point was, although we were using technology, it was the exact same ethos as the punk bands. I can't play, but I'll get a guitar and I'll learn three chords. That's how it all kind of started. So it's the same ethos, except I'll buy a synthesizer and a drum machine. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'll sit and do that and record it in my bedroom. And that's what it was all about. It was about the creativity and the freedom. It wasn't about being Rick Wakeman being a great player, you know.
Well, Dave and I, we weren't part of the team that invented the term New Romantic, but we were working at Smash Hits at the time, and the Face magazine actually came out of our office, didn't it, for a while. And we were probably the only two kind of pop and pop culture magazines in the country at the time that really benefited from bands looking this colourful. It was absolutely, because you couldn't print pictures of Blue Rondo a la Turk or Spandau Ballet, whatever, in the Enemy and Melody Maker, expected to look any good. So we loved it when we had pictures of Visage. Yeah. You know, it was absolutely fantastic.
So tell us about the Visage experience, because that then starts to happen at this time. You know, how do you get involved with that?
Well, the Rich Kids, kind of, you know, we were doing a split thing. No future, didn't know what we were doing. And Rusty and I wandering around the streets of London. He was feeding me because I had no money. We were absolutely skint. And Rusty is a very vibrant, loud character. He comes up with a million ideas an hour. And one of his ideas, he said, oh, yeah, let's get this band together with all our favourite musicians and, you know, we'll make some electronic music. And I went, stop. Okay, stop. Let's do that. So we did. We got John McGeoch there, the second from the left, from Magazine. Barry Adamson from Magazine, Billy Curry from Ultravox, Dave Formula from Magazine, all bands, musicians that we really rated and respected. And I came up with a name and I designed a logo and, you know, off we went. We started writing and recording electronic music simply to play in the clubs that Steve and Rusty were doing. So, Visage.
Forgive me if I say that the magic ingredient, apart from your music, was Steve Strange, yep. wasn't it? But who had no musical ability at all, is that right?
None.
I think at Smash Hits we always used to call him the Welsh Dresser, do you remember? In a very fond and affectionate way.
But you're right, Steve brought everything else. You know, the look, the connections, the fashion, the makeup artists, the front of it all. Look, we're all boring buggers. Look, all of us. Yeah. And there's Steve with the big quiff and the big shoulders, you know.
But he didn't even do very much, did he? He wasn't even particularly animated or anything, but he was just so clearly had spent so much time getting ready.
But you also have to remember, this was the era of the video.
Yep.
So you didn't have to be charismatic. You didn't have to be a great front man doing somersaults. This was a unit, a collective, that was never going to play live. You know, we weren't a band. We were a combination of characters, a bunch of musicians that got in the studio and made some music and then went off and did our other things. That was it. So it didn't have to be anything other than the face, the character. You know, so
why did that evolve? Was it anything to do with... Dave had a theory, we were talking to him earlier on today, about the idea that punk gigs and two-tone was actually quite violent. You know, if you went to those shows, I can remember there was just a lot of fighting, a lot of grief and a lot of aggression. And that if you dressed up and formed these little clubs where there was a kind of door policy where you couldn't get in unless you were looking absolutely fabulous and made a real effort and part of the club, then when you got inside, it was actually a completely different atmosphere, wasn't it? It was really, really kind of calm and safe.
Yeah, I think you're probably quite right.
Was that something to do with that?
I think it probably was. I think the grief that the kids that went to Blitz got was being on the bus dressed the way they were.
Yeah,
going there.
Yes, exactly.
You know? So and they did get grief. You know, it's crazy. But inside the club, it was perfectly safe. You know, there were no photographers, and unless they were part of the clique. And they were, so it was the insiders were there.
Yeah.
And the weird thing was that, you know, any movement, you know, whatever it happens to be, however crap the name might be, whatever it is, you know, it's not just musicians, it's not just kids dressing up in there. You could look round that room and see, you know, future fashion designers and future filmmakers and all sorts. They gravitate to that. That's what they want. They want to be there. They want to be in amongst these people.
Yeah.
You know, I was there the night the God turned up. Yeah, because all these kids were all massive Bowie fans, and Bowie turned up at the club, and all of a sudden, all these really cool, haughty, you know, lofty people melted.
Just went into
absolute hysterics and wet themselves because Bowie had turned up. You know, it was just fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's great when you get someone like Bowie going there to choose Steve and three others to be in the Ashes to Ashes video. You know, that's influential.
It is.
As flippant and silly as it might seem, that was making its own little statement.
Do you think in many ways that this was more significant than punk rock?
Oh, now there's a thing. I don't know if it was. I still think it's the same ethos, just different tools. It was all about DIY. It was all about make it up. The kids that went to Blitz hadn't anything. It was a three-day working week. It was the middle of Thatcher's Britain. You know, there was nothing going on. The club itself was in a really seedy part of town. It was horrible. And they went there, they raided their granny's wardrobe or did whatever. They were creative. They put this whole thing together without having two pennies in their pocket to rub together. So it was entirely DIY. Make your own music. If you've got a synthesizer, borrow something, record it, do whatever. Sound on sound, put little things and put out a record. And that was the ultimate punk ethos. It wasn't about big record labels and loads of money thrown at it.
That's a really good point. And so the managers would tend to be people who had no managerial experience. The photographers had never taken photographs before. Yes. The video directors didn't know one end of the camera from the other. So everyone was just making it up, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course they were making it up. Yeah. You know, I was there for the, you know, one of the first Spandau shows.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're seeing, you know, Robert Elms, you know, he was a journalist and broadcaster, and he was there as like the sixth member of Spandau, but he couldn't play. So he read a little poem before they came on announced the band on. And, you know, but that's how it always was, you know.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned earlier that you're doing two tours over the next 9 months or whatever. And this is the second of them with a band, which is starting in October. And this is to mark the fact that it's 40 years since 1979, where you did this extraordinary range of things, didn't you, in that year?
It was bizarre. I mean, you think Slick was 76, and by the end of 79, 3 years later, I was right in Vienna and producing the Visage album, which both kind of charted in 1980. So it's going out to celebrate that 1 year. Is quite something. It's a bizarre thing to do. It's interesting looking back at it, because you think, how could that possibly happen? How can I have two albums in the charts with two different projects, two different bands, or at the same time, or two singles in the charts at the same time? It's unheard of, you know.
And it gets even more extraordinary, because there's one stage, if I remember rightly, where you were pretty much getting up in the morning and promoting the Visage album. In the afternoon, you were writing songs for Ultravox, who wanted you to join. And in the evenings, you were out on tour in America playing live with Thin Lizzy. So, you know, how did that happen?
It is one of those things. Like, we were talking about this earlier. You know, I still have to pinch myself and decide, did Michael Jackson really marry Lisa Marie Presley? And was Midge ever in Lizzie? You know,
while simultaneously a member of Visage. It's amazing. So what happened? Gary Moore had left, hadn't he? And they just rang you.
Yeah, I was in the studio. I joined Ultravox, although nobody was interested in hearing that because Ultravox were deemed dead and gone. They'd been dropped by the record label, and John Fox and Robin Simon had left and all that. So I joined the band. You know, there was no point in talking about it. And I was in the studio putting the finishing touches to the first Visage album. And I got a phone call from Phil Lynott's management. And they said, look, Phil's going to call you in a minute. He's in Arkansas. So the phone rings, and it's Phil.
He's in Arkansas.
He's in Arkansas, yeah. And he said, Gary Moore's out of the band. He hasn't turned up for a couple of shows. Can you come out tomorrow and finish the tour? We've got another 3 weeks to go. Really? My brain was screaming, you're not good enough. My heart was going, go!
Yeah, absolutely.
America. I'd never been to America. Yeah. So I went home that night. And by the time I got back to my little flat, on the doorstep was a bunch of cassettes and a set list and a plane ticket and an itinerary. And it's like 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever. So I go back and I'm packing my case and thinking, oh, fantastic, America, this is great. And I look at the itinerary and it just said, if all I needed to know was what time's the car coming to pick me up, take you to the airport, great. So I got my big ghetto blaster because it was way before Walkmans and stuff and my headphones. And I thought, I'll learn the set on the plane. And they flew me out in Concord.
So you didn't.
I bet they only had 20 minutes to do it.
Nothing.
The one time you don't want to be on Concord.
I'm sitting in Concord with a big ghetto blaster and my big headphones, and some guy sitting next to me with a big cigar, thinking, "What the hell's next to me?" You know, I'm going.
That must have been thrilling. I tell you, I'm playing to what size audience? They were very big then.
They were special guests to Journey, so it was mega domes.
Yeah,
it was big. It was like
10,000 bigger than that.
20,000
seats.
And we did a festival in the middle of it all with Santana and Aerosmith and all of that. That was 100,000 people.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
And you so could learn. You did learn those songs.
Crowd you never played in front of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I learned the first night I got there was in New Orleans. So to fly to New York, connecting flight down to New Orleans, and I sat in a hotel room with Scott Gorham, the guitar player, and learning all those bloody harmony guitar parts because every song had
all twin harmonies,
and they're almost interchangeable. So I was petrified to get on and screw it up for them, but it was great fun.
That's but you fantastic. Said you say in your book you weren't up to the twiddly bits.
I'm not fast. I'm kind of. I learned from Eric. Remember, slow hand.
Yeah. Right. You know, it's
like, I don't do all that stuff. You know.
Right. Yeah. But you enjoyed it. You
were writing songs for Thin Lizzy as well at one point, weren't you?
Well, Phil and I had been friends. I saw Thin Lizzy play the Picasso Club in Glasgow in the very very early 70s when they were a three piece. Well, I think maybe the first time they'd come to the mainland. And I saw them because I used to be a fan of Skid Row, the original Irish three-piece Skid Row, who Phil used to sing for. I think. So I'd heard about Skid Row. And through reading an article about Skid Row, they mentioned this other band, Thin Lizzy. So I went to check them out. So I'd known Philip on and off for a few years and met up with him again when I moved to London to join the Rich Kids. So we were kind of mates, you know.
But you obviously...
Little and large of rock.
You think you need a different part of your brain somehow to apply yourself music to those two different things, but it probably
music's,
doesn't.
No. Music's either good or bad.
Yeah.
And it's you guys that categorise it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah. So... Ultravox, as you say, you know, at that point when you joined, we're kind of dead and buried, you know. John Fox had left and so forth. How did you get it back? How did they come back?
Luck again. I think luck's played a massive part in my life. You know, when I had someone written down, you know, the job prospects with Ultravox, you wouldn't have gone near them with a barge pole. You know, as I said, they owed a fortune to the record label. They'd been dropped. You know, lost a singer, lost a guitarist, all of that stuff. They already had three albums out. But the band was such a good band. We pulled our money, which we didn't have very much of. We pulled our money together to get one day in a rehearsal studio to see if it would work. And we walked in and we plugged in, and the noise we made was magnificent. It was huge. Synthesized bass, you know, guitar, drums and drum machine. Billy Currie's keyboard sounds. It was just, it was electric. It was fantastic. And we managed to con Thin Lizzy's management into, you know, taking us on. And we were such a pain in the backside as a band. We had record labels looking at us because they thought it was quite novel that I had joined the band. So there was maybe something there, they're not sure. And they kept saying to us, do some demos. And we said no. But sometimes when you make a demo, there's something magical about it you can never recreate. So we just kept saying no. And when you're desperate for a record deal, that's not the right thing to say.
No.
You know. So they eventually said, we'll give you 2 days in the studio. Let us hear something. So we went in, we recorded our first single. We gave them Sleepwalk as a that finished track, done, finished, mastered. And they signed us on the strength of that.
Right, right, right. And then Vienna comes along.
Yeah.
And is kept from the number one spot by...
Yeah. By John Lennon.
Absolutely.
And
yeah,
I don't have a problem with that.
I won't go into... I was intrigued to read in your book, Vienna becomes an enormous great hit.
Yeah.
But you write very well about the kind of lag between success and the fruits of success. and you know, during Vienna, to find out how Vienna's going, you're having to use a local phone box because there is no phone in your house. There's clearly no mobile phones and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, you're kind of putting pennies in pretty much to find out whether you've gone up to number 17 and so forth.
That's absolutely true. It's kind of how you did it. You know, you'd go down to the phone box in the morning, pretty stinky thing, and you'd phone the office and say, well, how are we doing? And they'd say, well, the reorders have just come in. You know, there's another 20,000 just been reordered by HMV or whatever. You go, that's great, fantastic. And then you'd go back again at 6 o'clock in the evening or whatever, and you'd phone up again and say, how did we do? You'd say, well, you've sold those 20,000 and they're about to put another order in tomorrow. You know, all the time I'm standing there counting out the pennies to make sure I could make the phone call.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're skint, you haven't got anything. It can take years before money, royalties. In those days, royalties would actually generate and come into your account. So I remember getting a phone call from my manager saying, you should think about buying a house. I said, buy a house? I can't even buy a burger. You know, what are you talking about? He said, the money's going to come in. You know, you're going to have to start thinking about what you're going to do with it, you know.
But the one reward that you notice quite early on is that as soon as you got a really big hit record, girls just suddenly find you magically attractive.
I was magically attractive and slick, I'll have you know.
But not as magically attractive. Is that fair to say?
What was bizarre, more bizarre, was that men started turning up at the shows. Because in slick shows, you didn't see any men. There were no men. But
men in Macintosh, fashionable belted Macintoshes.
Bizarre! It's like looking at it's like a horror movie. You'd look out into the audience, and there's all these guys with their moustaches all going. it's really weird. It's a weird thing to be a kind of odd fashion icon like that. So
How did you arrive at that sort of Ultravox aesthetic? Because watching those videos, you know, you used to think, well, you know, there was dry ice and there was suits of armour, and then there was wistful looking, rather fabulous blokes with pencil moustaches staring off into some distant spot, you know, and there was a kind of European aesthetic to it.
Sunday afternoon movies on telly. That's probably what it was.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, you think this was a period of kind of, you know, Blade Runner. You know, I think of Ultravox as like Blade Runner. You can't tell whether it's set in the past or the future. You know, it's got a bit of everything in there. The look, the sound of it, the videos, the imagery. You know, sometimes it's film noir from the 40s and sometimes it's futuristic with the electronics. And it was a bit like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, and the moustache came about because I was on a train from Glasgow to London, bored. And I went into the toilet and come back with a moustache. I had hair, by the way.
I was going to say, I thought you just suddenly grew.
No.
Pushing really hard.
Forcing out a moustache,
right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, Band-Aid, Live Aid, you'd known Bob Geldof for a while,
yeah.
Presumably before yeah. that happened. Now, at this point, his career was, let's be frank, was all over, wasn't it?
It was kind of finished, yeah. I think he was at home looking after babies.
You know. But you were doing well.
Yeah, I was still out there doing my thing. Ultravox was still in existence, and I think it was promoting a solo record at the time. I can't remember, but yeah, I was still out there doing it.
Yeah. And he contacted you and said he'd seen the Michael Burke report, Panorama. And
I happened to be on the Tube, the TV show in Newcastle. That Paula Yates co-hosted yeah. with Jules, and Bob had called Paula about something, and I'd known her for years, and she handed the phone to me and said he wants to talk to you, and that's he had just seen the Michael Burke footage, the first footage that we'd seen of the famine, and he said I want to do something but I'm not in a position to do it, will you help? And I hadn't seen any of this, and I'm instantly my thoughts were, oh God, well, I'm a bit busy, you know, I've got an album, and I've got this, and I've got that. But of course, by the time we met up, I'd seen the footage, so I knew exactly what he was talking about. Mm. And that was where we came up with the obvious conclusion that we're not capable of doing anything but maybe write a song. We had to write a song, we had to make it a Christmas song, because a record over the Christmas New Year period, the charts freeze, and you can generate twice as much from a number one record at that time. So it's quite cold and calculated what we did. We had to write a song. We couldn't just cover a Christmas song because, as I said before, 50% of the money generated from any single was to the writers. Mm-hmm. So we had to write something and then give the writing royalties to eventually what became the Band-Aid Trust.
And he already had a lyric that he'd pretty much written.
He had something that I think the Boomtown Rats had turned down. That shows you how good it was. But he didn't tell me that. He didn't. So I went home and I had my little Casio toy keyboard on my kitchen table, and I came up with the da 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 thing and recorded it on a cassette and sent it to him, and he said it was shit. And then he came over to my place the next day with a guitar with hardly any strings on it. He plays a right-handed guitar, left-handed, so it's upside down. And he started singing me this thing. And, of course, every time he sang it, it was different. So I had no idea that he'd actually written this. I thought he was making it up, and I was being, you know, quite graceful at that point. And I ended up just recording him singing it on a cassette because it was altering all the time. There was no melody. It was all over the shop. It was just... And I just finished building my first studio at the bottom of my garden. So I said, well, leave it with me, and I'll put these bits together. And I spent 4 days in the studio playing all the instruments and arranging the song. And of course, the last thing was, it's a song with no chorus. It's a really weird structure. Yeah. He was in the studio and he said, we need something like, you know, Happy Christmas, War is Over at the end. We need that kind of sing-along thing. And we came up with we hadn't put the Feed the World.
And he was the guy who got all the people to take part and to sing, but you were the musical director, weren't you? I mean, Dave and I actually were both there on that.
Yeah,
day,
thank recovering. God it wasn't the other way around. It'd be a very empty picture, it'd be a shit record.
Yeah. But how did you, it always interested me that, and I can remember seeing people step up to sing their single lines,
yeah.
And what incredible pressure in front of all those other people
Can you imagine standing there and that microphone in a big empty studio with a camera in your face,
and everybody watching,
and all of those other people all against the window on the other side.
It reminded me of people lining up to take a penalty shootout.
Yeah,
extraordinary.
Yeah, but with all of the other strikers from every other team watching you. Yeah,
watching.
But
you.
Of course, musicians are fantastically competitive, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and they can be. But I have to say, they were incredibly good that day. They were on best behaviour. You know, they came in and somebody coined the phrase, they checked their ego at the door, and it kind of was that way. It was great.
Yeah, I can remember Phil Collins being there and Status Quo, and Phil Collins was 33, I think, at the time. and considered to be a kind of just an old duffer, you know. And the idea that he was even mixing with people who were in their mid-20s, it was a real generational divide, wasn't it?
Well, you know, can you think of any other drummer who could have done what he
did? No, it was brilliant. It was fantastic that he was there, but I just that he would normally never have associated with people like that. It was going to be from a completely different generation.
Yeah, well, I think Phil's probably born the same day as us. He's around about the same age. You know, I think musically, the genre that he came from was seen radically different from anything that was up there. But, you know, it wasn't about that. It was about getting the biggest names you could possibly get.
I was just saying, it was just an odd combination.
Yeah, it was an odd combination.
You wouldn't think that now.
Poor guy just sat there for hours.
How did you cast those lines? How did you decide? It must have taken a huge amount of diplomacy to decide who was going to sing which line. Yeah. How did you keep everybody happy?
I didn't ask them. I got them to sing a couple of lines each. And then realised that we hadn't written enough lines for everyone to sing something. So we just kind of went, well, that half's pretty good from him, and then we'll cut it there, and then we'll put that half in there. So it wasn't... There's a moment in the making of video where I'm sitting with the lyrics and a pen, and I'm drawing lines through the middle of the lyrics, trying to figure out who's going to... where the split points are, so that everyone had a crack at singing it.
Yeah.
And it was more important that they all sang a line than it was Bob or I sang a line. So we're not on it. We're in the chorus somewhere, you know, doing whatever. But it wasn't a decision that you sat and made. It was a realisation that, oh, shit, they're all here and we don't know who's going to do what.
Right. So then, obviously, the show in summer of the following year... Do you remember much about that?
Yes. It flew by. Everyone had 18 minutes on stage. Before you walked on stage to do your bit, the stage manager said to everyone, okay, you've got 18 minutes. When you walk on either side of the stage, there's a traffic light system. So when you walk on, it's green. It's 16 minutes, it'll turn amber. And you won't see it turn red because the power goes off. And that's how they kept everybody in time, so nobody could overrun. So it was a scary prospect walking out, especially Ultravox, because we had flaky electronics, to say the least. So we chose songs that needed the least electronics so that hopefully nothing would go wrong, which it didn't.
And didn't Bob move your slot?
Oh, he's a bastard, yes.
Yeah, no, tell that story, because it's absolutely astonishing. He wanted to appear...
For the Royals. Yeah. Charles and Diana were there, and they were only allowed to stay for the first hour. And it wasn't the fact that they got changed. It's how it was done. It was very underhand. And I was told... It was something to do with, you know, can we swap places, because it's something to do with Adamant's equipment. And blah, blah, blah. I said, yeah, it's fine. Don't care. I'm not bothered. And it wasn't until after the event that I went out to the kind of backstage bar where all the press were there. And they're all saying, how does it feel to be shafted by your pal? I said, what do you mean? And I said, nah, you wouldn't do that.
Extraordinary.
But that's what I mean about musicians.
I know.
That's the way it goes. Now, you got involved in video a lot. I mean, you directed video. Is that something you look back on with fondness now that it's kind of the video age appears to have gone away now?
Yeah. It was a continuation, an extension of everything else that you did. I mean, most artists make the music and give it to the label, who stick it in a sleeve that the artists have nothing to say about. And then they are told on Monday morning, you're going to make a video, and they turn up in an empty studio, they've got no idea what the video is about, and the song is then interpreted visually into some other idea that the director's got, which has got nothing to do with the music. And we just thought, hold on a second, this is wrong. You know, we spent ages working on artwork and graphics and having the sleeve, you know, complement the music and vice versa, and design stage sets. And so the natural conclusion was that we would develop the video thing. When we worked on our first video, which is a thing called Passing Strangers, we worked with Russell Mulcahy. When he was this was his first video, I think.
He did all the Duran Duran videos.
He eventually did all the Duran ones. He did the Vienna one. And when we worked with Russell, we set the parameters of what the video was going to be. We said, you know, we were into photography. We said we want it in film, 16 mil. We don't want video. We're going to crop it top and bottom to make it look like CinemaScope. We want it to go black and white. We want it grainy. We want film noir. We want all of that stuff. And that was what that was the precedent set for all of this stuff. And then, of course, when the Vienna video came out, it was a replication of the Passing Strangers video. And then, as you say, Spandau and Duran and Elton and everybody else, McCartney, all wanted one of those, a little mini movie. So, yeah, I think it was an important time. It was another vehicle to get the music out to people. I had a conversation with the head of the label at the time when I said we wanted to make a video for Vienna, and he said, no. I said, well, don't you get it? I said, he said, it's number two. I said, well, it doesn't matter. I said, if we do a video for Vienna, we control how the image is, how the look is, in every crap television show in Europe. And because what you're doing is saying to the director of that programme, there's 5 minutes you don't have to think of. Here's 5 minutes of quality television you can just slot into your programme.
Right.
And eventually they kind of got it. So the artist talking the record company into doing it is mad.
Plus you're selling quantities of records in countries that you never have to visit, that you would never reach even if you'd spent an entire life touring out there.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It was a massive thing. It was the start of this whole video revolution, which burnt itself out pretty quickly.
I've got to ask you about three things.
Yep.
You know, your career has resulted in you doing things that would have been unimaginable 30 years ago. You've been on This Is Your Life.
Yes.
How was that?
It's like being at your own funeral.
And how did they spring it on you? Was it on the Johnny Walker show or something?
I had stung Geldof a year before, and because they were scared he was going to tell them where to go, and they thought he wouldn't if I was there. I don't know why. I was on the Johnny Walker show. I don't think it was being broadcast. They were not trying to pre-record or something. Yeah. Set up on the Johnny Walker show, and we were chatting about the Band-Aid song, and he said, "Oh, play me a bit of the Band-Aid song." So I'm playing it, and out the corner of my eye walks Geldof. And he says, "I got you, you bastard." And that was it. So, you know, This Is Your Life. Next thing, and you've been whisked off to, you know, this wake. Whatever. Everyone says really nice things about you, you know.
The weird thing, I was looking at it today, and what I couldn't get over is when you appear on the set, you're surrounded by your top showbiz mates, including Bruno Brooks, who's going, you know. Yeah. And I'm thinking, I don't think Mitch and Bruno Brooks know each other too well. But, you know, that's but you also, celebrity master chef?
Hey, my man of many talents. What can I tell you? You know, there's something bizarre about our industry. I think since the death of the, you know, people buying singles, records, whatever, the whole file sharing thing, people try and find other routes for you to promote yourself. So I've been asked on numerous occasions to go to the jungle or do some ballroom dancing.
Right.
You know, all of which had, you know, resounding no's attached to them.
The jungle doesn't tempt you.
Funnily enough, no.
Significant amount of money involved.
Well, I don't even want one of those flapjacks there. Never mind something that walks at me. So my agent got fed up with this. He said, "Well, what would you do?" And I just said, "Well, I watch, you know, MasterChef. I like that." And he came back 20 minutes later and said, "Right, you're on. Put your money where your mouth is.
What's cooking?" And so I got a picture of you here with Kate Bush. You must have had your picture taken with a staggering range of very famous people. Who's the most extraordinary one where you kind of look at and think, "I can't believe I met so-and-so"?
Well, that's not bad.
That's pretty good. Yeah, Nothing else. Okay.
I tell my kids, this is when we were going out together. You know,
right.
She wouldn't leave me alone. She was besotted.
You wrote your autobiography, 10 years ago now. Is it 10
more,
years ago?
Yes, more than
10
now,
years ago. I mean, do you feel like adding to it?
Well, I have. It's one of the. As long as you wake up in the morning, things happen. So rather than starting all over again, you just add bits to it. And I haven't done it for a while. I think the last edition was maybe 10, 12 years ago, whatever.
Right.
But yeah, things happen. As you said earlier, you couldn't write this down as a film script. You know, the stuff that happens is unbelievable. And I don't plan any of it. It just kind of comes my way.
But you've planned the next, you know, 6 months or whatever. You know what you're doing. You know, yeah. You've got a full diary. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think these days especially, you know, everyone's out touring because there's no, you can't generate income from records anymore. So everybody and his brother's out touring. So you have to book things way in advance. So this year, weirdly, and it's not something I've ever done before, I'm doing this question and answer, songs question and answer tour. It's like 16, 18 dates around the UK. Very loose, very casual, chatting to an audience, taking questions, playing with a couple of multi-instrumentalist guys with me, the Indie Electric Company. They're phenomenal young guys. And then celebrating 1980, doing the entire Vienna album and selected bits from the Visage album. I'd say I was going to play the entire Visage album, but I listened to it recently. It's not very good.
So you've among your children are musicians. Is that fair?
My oldest daughter had herself a top 40 record. Yeah, in a band she was in when she was 17. I said to her, she told me she wanted to join this band and make this record. And I thought, well, you could have done that on a state education. I've just paid a fortune for your education. Yeah. And you're going to join a band. You know, I did it for free. So, yeah, she...
What's the band called?
It was called The Faders. And a song called No Sleep Tonight. And it was a proper band. In fact, the three girls and the drummer's now playing with Simple Minds.
Right.
So really great, great band. And it, you know, it went the way of all things. You know, you make an album and then the second single doesn't do it, the album shelved, and you're washed up by the time you're 18, 19. So she went to the dark side. She worked for an agent.
So if you were, you know, talking to your 15-year-old equivalent now coming out of Glasgow, what advice would you give anybody starting in the music business?
Well, I'd advise myself not to write songs in such stupidly high keys because you're going to be singing them in 40 years' time.
So all those Sparks covers at least got you off to the right start.
I can still get there. I've got to take a run at it these days, so I still get there. Write, and then when you're tired, write and write some more, because that's the key to it all. You know, if you write the songs, you can control your career. And you can do it from, you know, behind a microphone or in front of a microphone or nowhere near a microphone. So it's a creative art that you can't be taught. You only do it by starting and writing really crap things and hopefully get better at it. So the writing is the absolute heart of everything. If you can, a bit like if Spielberg can make you, you know, scared of a big bit of rubber in the water and make you cry at another bit of rubber that's come from another planet, that's what you need to do with songs. You need to touch some of these heartstrings. If you're honest and straight about what you're writing, someone somewhere is going to get it and it's going to resonate with them. And that could change somebody's life.
Ladies and gentlemen, Midge.
Thank you.
Thank you very
this podcast
much.
Was brought to you by The Word.